Accession number 8736, room number 14.
Lord Harding, tape 14. Were you involved at all about this rearming of potential allies in the late 1930s? I know there was a programme, wasn't there,
yes,
for monitoring and rearming?
Yes, well, when the people gave up any hope of getting disarmament going through the League of Nations and so on, and war became more obviously imminent, the policy was to look around for arms and so on to help our potential allies. And I was given the job of doing this as in the MO1. And we had precious little stuff ourselves, so it was a pretty dim prospect. And they set up a big committee in the War Office of all the heads of all the munition departments, all the people concerned with arms and ammunition, explosives, and so on. It was quite a large committee. I suppose there were about 20 or 30 people, 30 probably. And there was a chap called Ackerman, who was the chairman, and I was told to take over as secretary. And he had a habit of taking the subject on the agenda, discussing it, reaching agreement about it, and then giving people a second chance. And it was a very good object lesson for me. It's one of the things I learned from him was never, 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 if you're the chairman of a meeting, don't ever give people a second chance. I mean, if they've agreed, that's it. Turn over the page and return to the next item on the agenda. And that's what Winston always used to do. And so that was a very good object lesson. But there was precious little stuff about. And we had a certain amount of stuff of our own, but there were people like the Balkan states, the Yugoslavs and the Bulgarians and the Romanians in particular. I don't think Turkey came into it, I don't remember much. But the one interesting thing was that I came across an Englishman who was a gunrunner. I mean, literally was. And he'd made a lot of money in the Far East. I think he used to supply arms and so on to the various warlords in China. And he was based in the Far East. And he must have done very well. And he had a house up at St. John's Wood. And he also had a stock of First World War arms in Liège, which he'd bought after the end of the First World War. And I was anxious to get hold of them because they were quite useful. I mean, they weren't first class, but there were things like Lewis guns and mortars and things like that. And they were quite useful. And so I got very closely involved with him. But he was a remarkable character. He had been literally a gunrunner. He had his house in St. John's Wood. And when I went there to see him, there was an outside gate. When you rang the bell, a little keyhole was opened and an eye would appear on the other side. I always say it was rather like a Cairo brothel. and then you were recognized and you were admitted. He had a wonderful collection of jade ornaments and old clocks, and also about half a dozen Siamese cats. So you can see what sort of a chap he was.
Did you actually get stuff from him?
I did.
Did you? I did
in the end. But he told me two things which I learned from him. And the first was that he told me that after the First World War, or sometime after it, the Foreign Office knew that he had these arms in Liège, and that he was open to selling them to whoever wanted anything, regardless of the political or strategic situation. And he said they tried to tie me down with an agreement. But I tell them that if they produced an agreement, they wouldn't be able to devise one that I wouldn't be able to drive a horse and cart to. And so that taught me a lesson that if you want to restrict people from doing things, you mustn't be too rigid or literal in what you ask them, how you help to tie them down. You must be a bit flexible, because the more rigid it is, the more determined they will be to drive a horse and cart through it. Now that is that I found a very useful lesson, particularly so in business, for example, in industry. And the other thing he told me on one occasion was, he said, "Now, young man, there are three lusts which men are subject to. There's a lust of money, there's a lust of women, and there's a lust of power. Now, when you meet the last one, my boy, you watch out, because that is the really dangerous thing. If you meet people, if you have to deal with people who've got a real, serious lust for power, they're dangerous." And that, I think, is terribly true. I told this story to Michael Hesseltine when I was sitting next to him at the dinner the Army Board had for the Queen Mother, just before Christmas. So he said, "Oh, but power is an important thing, because if you've got power, you can do a lot of good. And you can exercise it, and you exercise it with restraints, some strength." So I said, "Yes, sir, with constraints." And that was the end of that conversation.
So you actually got arms from this man, did you? And where were they sent?
Yes, we got things like Lewis guns and First World War mortars out of, you know, not the last edition. And passed them on to our potential. I don't think we got a great quantity, but we got some. Mm. But whether it had any effect on the course of the Second World War, I would doubt very much. In fact, I think it probably had no effect at all. But it was an exercise, and it was useful in the two lessons that I learned.
You were on the Committee for Imperial Defence, I think. Did you not represent the army on this committee?
No, I didn't. I used to go with Bob Henning, who was the MO, and I, Director of Military Operations and Intelligence. And there again, I remember on one occasion going to a meeting of the Committee of Imperial Defence with Bob Henning, walking down Whitehall, and we just had a problem of trying to get some concession or something, which the Navy had been successful in doing, and we hadn't. I don't know, I can't remember what it was, what concession it was we wanted. But I said to Bob Henning, who was a very able chap, I said, "Sir, why is it the Royal Navy can always get what they want and we have so much difficulty?" And he said to me, "Well, John, what you've got to remember, it's the people's navy and it's the king's army." Now that is almost literally true. And you see, the Royal Navy, the great majority of the people of this country think of the Royal Navy as the first line of defence of the kingdom, of the realm. And so, that is the attitude. And that is why the Navy at the present time are so lobbying so severe, so strenuously to retain their position as the first line of defence. I think. I don't say they're wrong in doing so.
Was that an interesting and valuable experience, you know, this interaction with the other forces for you?
Yeah. Well, you got to know, less at that time with the Air Force than with the Navy, but to a limited extent with the Royal. The Lords Commissioners were very much a law unto themselves then, and I think less so now, probably. But now those were, I mean, those were useful experiences, and had an effect on my attitudes, I suppose, in subsequent events. I think all the time you go on adding to your experience and taking note of what goes on. You'll make your mistakes like everybody else. And you make your wrong deductions. You'll make false deductions. You'll come to false and wrong conclusions. But by and large, I think if you don't take note of what's going on and what you're doing and the people you meet, the situations in which you're involved, well, then you're wasting your time. I've been lucky, very fortunate in the experiences that I've had and the people I've worked for. I mean, Bob Koenig was a very good leader and teacher. He used to, and other people that I worked for during those years in the War Office. And then, of course, in 1939, to my great delight, I was told that I was to take over command of the 1st Battalion of my regiment in India. And that, I think, I went out to India to take command, and they were then in Pune in July of 1939.
You were quite young, weren't you, to take command of a regiment?
About, I suppose, a little below average, but not all that. I was 43 at first time.
Was that a big thing, to be given command of your own battalion?
Oh, it was a tremendous thing. For an infantry regimental officer, the great thing is to get command of a battalion of your own regiment. I mean, that is the zenith of your career at that stage. And, of course, a commanding officer of a battalion or a regiment, a cavalry regiment, doesn't matter what it is, a gunner regiment, a sapper regiment, doesn't matter what it is, you're in a very, very strong position. Anybody starts inspecting officers, starts to criticize you about this or that, they always say, well, no, sir, I'm very sorry, but that's our regimental custom.
I see.
So you can get away with murder sometimes.
What was your rank then?
I was a lieutenant colonel. I was a brevet major, a brevet lieutenant colonel. I'd been given a brevet lieutenant colonelcy while I was in the War Office. That doesn't carry any pay with it, but it's just an honorary rank. But it's a step. Yes, I think I was a brevet lieutenant colonel. I went out and took over command of this battalion, which was then in India, and was made a substantive lieutenant colonel. Unfortunately, I had to leave my wife behind. She was going to come with me. And then we had a son who was at boarding school. And we decided that, war being imminent, we might find ourselves in three continents. I mean, I might have been in India or elsewhere. She would be in England, and our son won't be anywhere. So we decided that she was to stay at home until after the summer holidays and then come out and join me. But in the interval, of course, war broke out. So we agreed that she should stay at home. And because she might have been stranded in India with our son in England and me, well, God knows where, anywhere.
How did you react to war's outbreak, being in India? Were you sorry that you weren't in Britain?
Yeah. I was very concerned for two reasons. I think, first of all, the 2nd Battalion of my regiment had been marooned in India during the First World War and had taken no active part in the war at all, which they felt very keenly. And I thought the same thing might happen to me and my first and my return. And the other thing, the frustrating thing was that the high authorities, the high command, and I think the government in India, at that time, in the middle of 1939, when war broke out, took the view that the war would be short-lived and would be all over one way or the other in a matter of a year or so. And therefore, it was pointless to develop an increase and build up the Indian Army, which I thought was completely wrong. Absolutely a completely wrong point of view and outlook at all. Because I used to say to them when once I met, well, look here, it takes you 6 months to train an Indian soldier to put his hat on properly. And it takes you much longer to teach him any English so that he can work his signals and signaling apparatus to communicate with the British unit. So why not just concentrate on doing that? But they didn't increase or develop or build up the Indian Army. They didn't develop up their limited potential for weapon production in any way. And I thought this was terribly wrong and terribly frustrating. But of course, I mean, I was just a battalion commander in a remote part of the Punjab, Multan, and I had nobody took any notes of what I said, quite rightly, probably. But those are the two feelings that I had. Two of great frustration. I wanted to run an exercise for my battalion across the Indus because I'd been given the job of doing a reconnaissance of that approach into India through the pass that runs the other side of the Indus. And although I personally didn't anticipate an invasion of India from then, I wanted to do an exercise across the Indus to deploy and to give my battalion experience of that particular piece of geography. I had the greatest difficulty in getting half a dozen lorries to provide the necessary transport that we needed for that. The whole thing, the whole time was very frustrating. But then we were told that we were to be the British battalion of the Kohat Brigade. And we went up to Kohat. This must have been in that winter of 39-40. And we went up and we did a month's mountain warfare training, which was very useful. And then they had I suppose, must have been in the spring that year. They began an operation in what was called the Ahmadzai Salient, which was part of Waziristan, north of Banu. And we were sent up then with the Kohat Brigade to cover this building of road and pipeline, which I told you about earlier on. And then we were actively employed on the frontier as picketing troops and so on, and helping building the road and the pipeline and so on. So that was a valuable experience. And then I was told, I suppose it must have been in the early summer, I was told that I was to go to do a staff job at Rawalpindi as a G1, which was a sort of normal progress, you know, of promotion, and mixing regimental service with staff work. I was horrified at this, and I thought, my God, this really means I will be marooned in India for the rest of the war. So I appealed to my brigadier, who was very good, very understanding. And he appealed to JHQ about the posting, and it transpired So I was told, and I may be romancing here, but I was told afterwards that there was another gunner officer in Rawalpindi who was about the same age and had the same sort of qualifications as myself, but who also had two marriageable daughters and who wished to remain in India for that reason. And so GHQ India, whether it was for that reason or out of other, for other reasons, or anyway, as far as I was concerned, to me it was in their wisdom, they decided that this chap should take over this staff appointment in Rawalpindi, and that left me in the open. So then I was told to go to the Middle East. Archie Wavell, that's what I was told, had asked for a nucleus, a divisional staff of four staff officers, a nucleus, a potential G1 and a G2 on the operational side, and an AQ and a DAG on the administrative side. And so I was detailed as the potential G1. And there were other three other very good chaps. I can't remember their names now, but if I had time, I would remember them. Who, and we went together by boat to the Middle East, to Port Said. And on the way there, we went in a ship, in a trooper, which was carrying Australian troops to the Middle East. And the only thing I remember about that trip was that as we approached the Red Sea, there was an air alarm. Some Italian aircraft were threatening to bomb the convoy, in which we joined a convoy at the sort of entrance to the Red Sea. And this Italian group of bombers were attacking the convoy. But it was an interesting episode dealing with Australians, because when the alarm blew, they all rushed up on deck. And so my three companions and I just said, well, go down below at once, you know. We said, well, wait a minute. And they responded. And this is the way, I think, with those sort of troops who got very independently minded. You've just got to assert your authority with them. So that was a good lesson. Anyway, we got to the Middle East. We reported at GHQ in Cairo. And we were told that Archie Wavell was in hospital. So we went along to the American hospital at Gazeera to see him. Three or four of us, and he said, well, anyway, glad to see you. I'm very sorry to tell you that you may think you're here under false pretenses, because there's no division for you for which you to be the nucleus staff. But I thought it would be a good thing to have a reserve of trained staff officers. So, well, that was that. Then I was, Jock Whiteley, whom I knew very well, was PGS operations at GHQ. And I was left in the limbo for a bit, and then I was told that I was to go to Crete to do administrative reconnaissance for developing Crete as a base of operations in Greece. And fortunately for me, this proved abortive. I don't know why, but I didn't go. And then Sandy Galloway, who was BGS of British troops in Egypt with Jumbo Wilson at that time, fell ill of malaria. And so I was put in to deputize for him while he was in hospital. And that was when the operation, the offensive in the Western Desert was being planned. So I, fortunately for myself, came in on that on the ground floor. It was very, very well and secretly prepared, and nothing was put except on manuscript on paper. Dick O'Connor was absolutely insistent on this. So there were no typewritten orders or plans or anything. The whole thing was done verbally or in manuscript. And that maintained absolute secrecy, because Cairo, of course, was a hotbed of spies and informers of every description. And so that the planning for that operation was kept completely secret, and that was one of the important elements in its eventual success. So I came in on that on the ground floor, and then I was Tandy Galloway came back, took over, and I was told to go and be a liaison officer between Dick O'Connor, commanding the Western Desert Force, and Jumbo Wilson, commanding British troops in Egypt. So I went up, joined up with Dick, of course, whom I knew quite well from my staff college days, and I spent all my time with him. I do remember, I think I went back once to Cairo to report to Jumbo Wilson or Tandy, but primarily I was with Dick O'Connor all the time, with his advanced headquarters and so on.
So you wouldn't have been with your regiment at all then, during the war?
No.
You were seconded?
No, I left my regiment in India and then started off on a staff career.